This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
By state, we have the most plates from Texas, for example, which has had the greatest number of executions. Takes up a big wall. She has an illustrated every Last Supper request from every person on death row. She's doing about 50 plates a year, and she's been working for over 10 years, so she's up to 500 plates. But we do have 167 plates, for example, from Texas.
So she paints a picture of the actual food. So there'll be like three tacos kind of standing on edge, like you'd see in a commercial. She does pictures of like Fanta bottles and RC Cola, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, you know, they're monochrome. They're just blue, and you can see what the stuff is. They're sort of, would you say they're slightly cartoonish, or what is that effect she's
They look
going
almost
for?
Like watercolors in monochrome.
Right.
You know, so they're intentionally monochrome and not brightly colored. There's a sort of somber aspect to that. She mentioned at the gallery talk on Sunday, I thought this was very interesting, that she has done two plates for people who have been exonerated. So they're no longer on death row, and she painted those in full color.
So they got a request and then they somehow got off?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right. You may be aware that there are things like the Innocence Project that mm-hmm. tries to see whether or not people are on death row unjustly.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know the circumstances of those two particular individuals, but she painted their plates differently.
Right.
And she painted the meals they ate after they left the prison.
Oh, okay.
On the outside.
What kind of stuff did they have?
I think one of them went to Burgerville. I don't know what the other one did.
Julie started this because she lived in Oklahoma, where they have a lot of executions. And
highest per capita number right. of executions in the country. She was living in Oklahoma. She was teaching there. And she read a description of a last meal in the paper. And that's something your listeners might also like to know, is that this is public information and it's often published in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why it's published in the newspaper. Seems to be a tradition of some sort. People maybe just want to know, or the state wants to provide that information. But she read it and she told me it stuck with her. She started cutting these out of the paper and saving them. One of the questions I asked both artists on Sunday is, how does a project like this begin? What's the impetus? And so that was the impetus. And like many artists, Julie began collecting information before she knew what to do with it. She also told me that she tried embroidering the description of the meal, like on a napkin or a tea towel to start with. But that wasn't it. That wasn't quite right. So she moved to Oregon to teach at Oregon State. And when she got to OSU, she thought of this idea for painting on the found plates. And then she began working with the technician to make that possible. So she paints and then the plates are fired. But when people come out, she didn't make each plate. She collects those plates and sort of has them at the ready to paint on.
Yeah. So she paints and then fires them as a kind of way of finalizing this.
Yes.
So that it'll be there for, you know, thousands of years if it was just buried in the ground or you could use it for a couple of decades.
Right. It's both lasting and fragile because it's a plate.
Right. The reason people read this stuff in the paper, probably the same reason people will go to the gallery.
Maybe.
Because they're just curious. How do you sum up your life or your last pleasure? And then they'll see this food and it's very thought-provoking.
It is, because it is personal. So I think Julie felt that illustrating these meals was a way of, even though she leaves off the name, she does not include the name of the person who was executed in the text, the menu text. But to have the menu and to have the plate is a way of memorializing that person and their individuality, maybe more than a name. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting. It's a different experience to be in the gallery with these 500 plates and with the prison illustrations than I had anticipated, because it is a bit like going to a cemetery.
You mean the interaction between the two?
Yeah, I mean just the visitor standing in the gallery looking at these 500 plates, you become very quickly aware that these are 500 people that are no more.
Mm-hmm.
And so Julie's also accompanied the exhibition with a video where she presents each plate and reads the menu rather slowly. So it's a way of memorializing someone without saying their name. That's part of what intrigued me as a curator about how she's gone about it.
The all 500 are read out on the video?
They are.
How long does the video take?
Actually, it's not all 500. She clarified that Sunday. She's done about 100 of them. It takes about an hour.
Mm-hmm. And it's a steady drone in the background.
It is. Because she takes her time. I mean, I think each individual is given their due.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a speed reading thing.
Right. Seems to be the way things are done now. People get their name read out at 9/11 or Oklahoma City. Every chair has a name.
Right.
We're sort of, can't get beyond the individual. And in the end, mm-hmm. each individual must be recognized.
I think so. I think there's a human impulse to do that. And this Julie's work recognizes that. Buddy's work is kind of a contrast.
Mm-hmm.
Because his drawings are all, as we look at it, rather anonymous, very warehousey kind of buildings. He hasn't chosen to illustrate old prisons. He was talking about just not wanting that nostalgia factor or kind of beautiful old architecture of some of the old prisons.
He said San Quentin will be turned into condos.
Yes.
And that's a fact.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And he doesn't want any romance. He wants
No, it's not a romance prison. Novel with That's not what
it's
it
not
is.
It's not a Johnny Cash song.
It's not a Johnny Cash song. No. It's a very anonymous looking kind of architecture. I did not include, but he has painted Walmart distribution centers, which are also often located in the same kind of rural western desert-like landscapes and have the same kind of sprawling industrial architecture. They're not dissimilar. I didn't include any of those because I just wanted to include the prisons.
Yeah, the main one that faces the windows and mm-hmm. faces the majority of the plates.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that one's called? Which prison it is?
I can't remember. I think it's in Corcoran, one of the Corcoran facilities. It might be in Delano, California.
California.
I could check for
it. If you can picture a series of concrete boxes that just seem to infinitely regress. There's a watchtower every sort of 100 yards, which looks like a control tower at an airport, one of those. And it seems to be like a dozen of these towers receding into the distance. And he said it's two prisons. One is a treatment center, one is a sort of more of a prison. And it is that big. It's just gigantic.
Right. And the listener might imagine that these are four out of the five large drawings that we're showing are very monochromatic, ink on paper, pencil. And it's just the prison kind of along their horizon line, this long just set of boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Buddy was saying that you don't actually see it like that when you're out there, because as you go by along the road, you know, trees have been planted, berms are in place. You can't really stop, not allowed to stop and take pictures of a prison, but he has built up his resource materials using video camera. And then the work takes place back in the studio.
Yeah, he has a mount where he drives by videoing.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, if he gets beyond a berm or gets up to a fence, when he comes to do the drawing in the end, he ignores all the obstructions, like removes them. So you have this image that doesn't exist in real life, but it is what he's looking for.
Right.
And I think he's trying to tell us that prisons are bigger than ever and there's more of them than ever, and they're kind of like corporate buildings.
They are.
Well, they're run by corporations, so.
They are, and the question also came up in the talk on Sunday. Someone said, you know, we don't want to have prisons in our backyards, and he made the comment that actually many communities do want to have the prisons, especially rural communities, because they're a source of jobs. In particular, in Buddy's case, to go back to the question of why does somebody start to do this, he's from Southeast Maryland. He lives in Seattle now and has for many years, but not too far from where he grew up. They did build one of these prisons, and he knew people who were incarcerated, and he also knew people who worked there. So he became interested in what was going on. So that was the starting point for him. And then it also became an exploration of landscape. I mean, these are landscape paintings in the same way that Julie's are still lifes. So in terms of an art form, it's a landscape painting. But what is in that landscape? You do have the sense of that open, austere, high desert Western landscape. And if it were romanticized, you know, these would be the Old West towns or pueblos or something like that, but they're not, they're prisons.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBO Radio. This week our guest is Terry Hopkins, director and curator of the Art Gym at Marylhurst University. The shows she's curated are Julie Green's The Last Supper and Buddy Bunting's The Prison Industrial Complex, and they run through May 17th. The Art Gym is south of Lake Oswego on Highway 43. Buddy said one thing that got him into this was he tried to send art supplies to a guy he knew who was inside.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And they were refused. The prison wouldn't let him do it. So he started thinking about what it's like on the inside.
Right. Both of these artists are looking at this from the outside. We did have people on Sunday who are part of the movement to abolish the death penalty. We had people that do bring art supplies and work with prisoners to make art. In the system, one woman, Donna Sleepak, brought several paintings that were done with M&M, you know, the outside coating of an M&M. that pigment. That's how
those butterflies?
Those butterflies, that's how those were made.
So colored butterflies about 10 inches across in frames. They were done with M&Ms.
They were done with M&Ms.
I wrote about a show of prison art in Portland about 5-6 years ago, and a lot of the art there was done with coffee. The prisoners would use coffee crystals as a kind of watercolor medium. And so there was a lot of, you know, pictures of Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash and, you know, Indian chiefs, things like that, all in the same kind of sepia tone.
Interesting.
So basically, you can't really get art supplies on the inside.
I don't know the logistics of all that, but from what I've heard from the people who talked to me recently, it sounds like it's difficult, a difficult thing to do. And I think this, sometimes when I curate, I like to do things that are more indirect. And this combination, both artists are looking at things as outsiders. Julia has not met the people on death row. She has not been in the prisons. But there's this evidence that is in the public that she is calling attention to a practice, not only of the last meal, but obviously of the death penalty. But I think that one of the things that artists do is find a way that's powerful to direct our attention or call our attention or reinforce the fact that we have work to do on an issue, even if they don't tell us what that is. She is against the death penalty, and she does mention that in her texts that accompany the exhibition. But I think she's letting this practice speak for itself by making these plates and by making so many of them over time. One person came up to me and said, you know, are these our two alternatives, the death penalty or larger and larger and more prisons? So I wanted to show these two things together. I think it's different to see the prisons and by themselves or see the plates by themselves. It's different to see them together.
Right.
It puts you in a different frame of mind. On the one hand, you have evidence of these lives that are no longer, so 500 individuals. On the other hand, Buddy's drawings often have no figures in them, or just maybe a handful of figures exercising in a yard, something like that. So the people are not visible.
And it's not all, I mean, his work, he was amazed at the number of people who were in these prisons for shoplifting because of a three strikes rule. So it's not just about warehousing dangerous criminals, it's warehousing this burgeoning population of people who've, you know, done crimes. Maybe they shouldn't be in prison. That's his opinion. When you look at the plates, it's also very difficult to not be emotionally engaged. I mean, one of them, there are some real heartbreakers, and you don't know who your heart is breaking for. It could be some monstrous murderer. But, you know, one of them was, he was, what, 44, and he'd never had a birthday cake? And so the guards or somebody got him a birthday cake for his last meal. I mean, how poignant is that?
There was another prisoner who did not want a last meal, but that he asked that a meal be delivered to a homeless shelter, and the authorities refused. And the public responded by delivering many meals to the homeless.
Like 100 pizzas or something, or 140.
Something like that. So that's rather interesting. There's also, I think, besides a sense of loss even though we don't know these people, we don't know the circumstances, we don't know their crimes, we only know what they ate. They were human beings, so there's still a sense of loss and memorializing them in some way, regardless of a crime. But there's also, for me, a sense of almost invasion of privacy. That seems like the state is making something public that maybe should be private. I'm not sure. You know, it seems very intimate. And it is also interesting to me that quite a number of prisoners, I noticed, especially in Virginia, who knows why that is, the plate says, did not want last meal request released to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the people on death row seek to retain a certain kind of dignity and privacy around that final decision.
It's a bit like taking a picture of a dead body in a electric chair. You know, people do it as a kind of final act of degradation or revenge, and they'll circulate it. So
yeah.
Maybe that's why the state does it. There's no reason why we should know what they ate, I don't think.
No, and on the other hand, as you were saying earlier, it gives us a sense of something personal. And as Julie says, it humanizes this individual.
Mm-hmm. One of them, I think it was Louisiana, the prisoner requested shrimp, but shrimp was not available in the vending machine. And it turned out that prison, last meals had to be, they could be shared with their relatives, but they had to come from a vending machine. So it makes you wonder what they have in their vending machines.
It does. But some of the meals looked rather delicious, I have to say, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a lot of junk food. You can't deny that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are dreaming about McDonald's when they're inside. It's just, to me, that's sad.
I'm looking at one of the plates here, and the request was fried chicken and watermelon.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't sound bad.
Someone ordered a vegetarian pizza, I noticed.
Vegetarian pizza. This person in New York on August 15th, 1963, ordered a pack of Pall Mall cigarettes.
Right.
That's a lot of things to look through. I hope people will come out and experience this as a whole. I think it is an experience that it's difficult for us to describe what it's like on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the Art Gym is a big open airy space and has very high ceilings. It's in an old building with those arched windows, and it often has a sacred feel to it, and especially depending on what's in it. I think that's probably the case for this show. So it is, I think, a good space to contemplate these issues and to think about where we are as a society with regards to how we handle people who kill other people.
Mm-hmm. Having 500 things on the wall to look at, most people would go, maybe I'll look at 50 and move on. But this place, this show, you could look at all 500. You're kind of in a trance, moving from one to the next. I think because they're all similar size and the same kind of subject matter, but there's enough variety that you're constantly amazed, and you do get drawn into the humanity of the people it represents.
We've also organized it, Julie's work, very intentionally, so that you're aware of the relative numbers of plates for each state. I wanted to present it in part as data. It's almost like a bar graph on the sideways, so that you can also have a sense of relative numbers of executions by state.
Right. So there are, what, 16 states? That had the death penalty.
Something like that.
So
there are like 18 states and jurisdictions.
Okay.
So DC and forget the other one. District mm-hmm. of Columbia has the death penalty. There's one plate from the District of Columbia. The last execution was 1981.
Mm-hmm. Buddy's work, the drawings are huge. I mean, he said some of these sheets of paper cost like $150. So he doesn't like to make mistakes.
Right.
He works in his basement on them, and he draws them in pencil, then he goes over them in ink. And they're very minimalist. You know, the shadows are very, basically you're getting outlines and shadows, mm-hmm. and there's no background. They're just sort of floating, right? He doesn't include the mountains or anything in the back.
No.
So it's just the building and the sort of light towers and watchtowers. And I think it will make people look, you know, when they're driving down the highway and they see one of these, I think it'll make them look again because they're just so big. Mm-hmm. And they're so, you know, cut off, obviously, from the outside.
Right, and I think both artists have been working on these projects for over 10 years. So they're ongoing. And that's another thing of interest.
Right. I'm Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest was Terry Hopkins, director and curator of the Art Gym at Marist University. The show there runs through May 17th, and the gallery is open Tuesday to Sunday, noon to 4, and the 35 bus goes there from downtown. So thank you very much for coming in, Terry.
You're welcome.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall.
It's time for KBOO News at Noon for today, Tuesday, April 23rd. I'm Desiree Garcia. Amongst a sharp divide on the issue, France legalized same-sex marriages last Tuesday. Though there was little debate when the issue was first brought to the forefront, opponents say they oppose how it was brought up and the fact that same-sex marriages include adoptions. France is the 14th country to legalize same-sex marriages, and votes came in 331 to 225, with the majority in Socialist Majority National Assembly Party. It is believed the first weddings can occur as early as June. Leash up, scoop up. Portland's Park Bureau is approaching City Council this Wednesday regarding granting park rangers the authority to cite pet owners who don't leash their dogs or pick up their waste. Under Multnomah County law, at the moment, park rangers can only give verbal warnings or ban offenders from parks for a certain period of time. This ordinance would only be an amendment to present code. Yesterday, School of the Americas Watch, or SOA Watch, won a major victory when the Pentagon was ordered by the United States District Judge Phyllis Hamilton to release the names of trainers and teachers at the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or SOA WINSEC, a U.S. military training school for Latin American soldiers. Human rights activists have linked alumni from SOA WINSEC to human rights abuses throughout Latin America, including death squads, repression campaigns, and military dictators, and after SOA Watch had compiled and presented this information to congressional decision makers, the Department of Defense refused to further release it. The bill was amended by the House of Representatives in 2009, but with a loophole that defense Robert Gates could ignore the request to release information in the case of quote-unquote national interest. SOA Watch and other human rights organizations want to use the information to shed light on how SOA WINSEC has impacted Latin America and encourage Congress to make wise decisions regarding military training. Though the Ladies in White won the European Union's Sokolov Prize in 2005, they are just now picking it up this year. That's because they are a Cuban opposition group that formed to demand the release of their loved ones from prison in 2003 and were known for marching all in white. At the time they received the award, they were not allowed to leave the country. This year, Cuba has eased travel restrictions. Meghna Rao, a student at Jesuit High School in Beaverton, traveled to the White House this week with 30 other students to show off their science projects at the White House Science Fair. President Barack Obama looked at her project, among others, which studied biochar, a type of charcoal that efficiently stores carbon. Rao has also helped found a group, Portland Junior Scientist, connecting underprivileged children with high school students through science projects, which was incorporated by law firm Adder Wynn. This is Desiree Garcia with KBOO News.